Raphael Weinroth Brown is an internationally renowned Canadian cellist, multi-instrumentalist, and composer. He merges his classical cello training with a love of progressive metal and Middle Eastern music, and has formed several acclaimed ensembles, including The Visit, Muskox, and Comancello. This duo is with a previous guest of this podcast, Comanche player Shahryar Jamshidi. Raphael has been touring with the Norwegian progressive band Leprous since 2017 and has appeared on over 150 studio albums. In 2020, he released his first solo album, Worlds Within. Raph is a very thoughtful and articulate person, and this conversation touched on many interesting topics. This part two is a bit shorter than part one, has more music, and includes some interesting background on Raph's development as a musician. He also shares his advice on building relationships in the music business to help artists find different avenues to promote their music. He speaks about improvisation, his love of Middle Eastern music, and his collaboration with Shahryar Jamshidi in Comancello. If you missed part one, it is linked in the description of this episode. In part one, he demonstrated and talked about the first part of Worlds Within, and you got to hear about his career as a studio musician and his experiences touring with Leprous. He also shared his thoughts about knowing yourself, being creative, connecting with your audience, and balancing your life and expectations of yourself. I'm curious what you were like, 10, 15 years ago as a young teenager, because a lot about you seems like you would have been a joy to teach, but maybe a little bit challenging for your teachers.
Yeah, probably pretty challenging. I think that, the thing about me is that, like, I've always had a pretty clear internal compass, like, always had a clear sense of where I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And I think I've always been a selective learner. So, like, if a teacher said some stuff to me and I wouldn't just like absorb all of it and then just do all of it, I would kind of think critically about it and, you know, take some things, but not take all of it. I think I have a certain like defiance. Like for me, like I would want to prove something to the teacher that I also knew something, you know, and that like, that I'm not just like a blank slate. Like, I would say, like, looking back on, you know, my student days, I can really see that. And I can see that, like, I think that teachers probably like the fact that, you know, I was, like, kind of hungry for it all the time. But there's also a feeling of, like, I was hungry for it, but for my own reasons. And because for me, the lessons and the learning were not the objective. They were a means to an end. Mm-hmm. And I already had an idea of where I wanted to go, kind of a general idea. And when I'm presented with a piece of music, I have strong opinions about it. And we might not share those opinions. I think that probably it was like challenging for some of my teachers, but also I think like I've always, for the most part, had a good relationship with them. But actually there was a point, like, you know, of course, as you go on as a student, right, like, you know, you go to grad school and stuff, you become more independent. You're not like so much under the wing of your teacher in the same way, usually. And for me, it was definitely like that because my teachers didn't even live in town. They would just come and like visit and then like give like, you know, lessons like once or twice a month. And then I was left to my own devices. So then I kind of felt like it was more like a master class or coaching where it's like, I just needed to have stuff ready. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then they would kind of give whatever they had to offer. And then I would go back to sort of my own independent work. But I remember like at the end of studying, I had like a chamber coaching and I remember the teacher was like asking me to play in a certain way. And, you know, I was there with my group and I just said, no, I don't agree with you. I'm not going to do that. And that was, for me, that was the end. You know, I knew I wasn't going back to school at that point. I had finished at GGS and I was like, I'm not doing school anymore. Like, I can't do this. I just want to be in the real world, like doing my thing and making a living. And who cares, like, if, you know, I'm not going on the right path, I just need this for me. So I just felt ready for that. But then it was sort of like this last straw thing where I just went, nope. And then he just kind of realized like he couldn't push it because, it just wasn't happening, you know, and I was going to just play it in my way. And that was it, you know, at that point. And then I just, you know, so I think that, like, that's also when you know that you're maybe ready. It's like when your opinions are too strong and you just need to learn for yourself, and like experience teaches you. And sometimes something that your teacher told you years ago clicks for you later on in life, but it took you that long to get there, but you had to get there on your own. You couldn't like just get it from them then. You weren't necessarily ready to absorb it, but that's because I think a lot of these things come from life experience. And you know, you come to certain types of music also in your own time. Like there was a lot of repertoire that I like, I just wouldn't play, you know? And then later on I understood like why it was maybe good music, mm-hmm. you know, and why I would maybe want to play it. And I think that's like, it has to do with evolving as a person, and like your tastes change, and your, you know, life experience teaches you to feel things in a different way and understand like, you know, types of music that you didn't connect with before. And I feel that so much, that there's things that like, yeah, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I would have written music in a certain way. And now what I'm looking for and what I create is altogether different. And so that has a lot to do with me and my experience and where I'm at in life. And, you know, and eventually all of our cells in our body are replaced. So we're biologically different people. And so we can't be fully the same, but we can also like understand where we came from, you know. So you always have that part of you there, but at the same time, it exists more as memory than it does really as part of your actual physical being. So that's a kind of an interesting thing, not to get too trippy there, but like, yeah, you know, I would say there's a lot of things that, for example, that I learned from my teachers that, not that I learned so much, that I was just kind of hearing from them, that wasn't important to me then, and now it's important to me, but for my own reasons. And I think that's very powerful, you know, when you come to it in a place where you feel like it's important. And so then you take ownership over that thing. You're not doing it for someone else. And I think that's the whole trouble of being a student, actually, is that you see people who they've been to so many different teachers, and they're bringing all this stuff to the table that's like all these mixed messages a little bit. And like, if they don't really have their own voice or their own experience of like being able to get out there and play that thing and understand what works, then it's like they just have all these conflicting voices, and they're trying to synthesize them into a piece of music that's not their own. And then it's really hard, you know? And so I think that like, I always felt that like as a student, even like, you still had to play like a master, you know, you still had to own the music almost as though you had written it. And that like, if you kind of came to it from a place of trying to please other people and make sure that everyone was satisfied, that it wouldn't be authentic and it wouldn't kind of all come together as one thing. And yeah, so just this idea of being able to, I guess, feel that something is important because it's important to you. That's, I mean, nothing can really replace that. Like, you can't do it because it's important for someone else. You know, I think that an audience will feel that too, mm-hmm. you know, that it's like, it's important to you to play a certain way. And I see that a lot in musicians. I can see what their priorities are from watching them play. Thank you.
Beautiful, thank you.
Thanks. Anyway, yeah, so that's the beginning of the record, and it's like I've kind of gotten into the habit of starting my shows with that because it doesn't kind of give the audience too much too soon, and it's actually a nice way to begin if you haven't been playing already. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, we've been talking for like 2.5 hours, so like, you know, it's a nice thing to play first as opposed to something that's like, you know, that's very technical and it's kind of very, you know, sort of has to be done very precisely. It's like there's a lot of space to kind of just ease into it. And that's also what I like about playing the album, is that like it starts off really minimal and then it gets to all the technical stuff in the middle, and you feel like by that point you've been on stage for a little while and mm-hmm. you're kind of ready to attack it.
Yeah.
So
one thing maybe you can't really show us today, but I encourage people to check out the percussion effect you do with your bridge. It's very cool and unique.
I could demo it quickly.
Yeah.
I'll just play a bit of that. So now it's looping. So on and so forth. So I mean, it's just a quick demo of what that does, and the sound basically can actually shift the camera a little bit just to show what's happening mm-hmm. down here. But so I've got a Shatton bridge pickup, and it's on the bass side of the bridge, and I'm just thumping it with my middle finger, and then I'm flicking the opposite side of the bridge with my other middle finger, with the nail. So then I get, it's kind of like, it's not even really like a snare, it's kind of like a cross stick. It's very much like a hip hop beat, you know. And of course, I mean, what you're seeing is different from what you're hearing. So you're hearing a lot more hits, and that's being produced by delay pedal. So if I just go single hit, you hear the delay coming off of it. And then I can adjust the tempo, but then once it's there, it's there. So really, it's up to me to play rhythmically. And if I don't play rhythmically, you can kind of hear that on every loop. You know what I mean? So I can do a slower beat where it's like an eighth note. I guess you could call it an eighth note pulse, where it's like. So for example, on Worlds Within, the piece Tumult 4 is based around that. It's a cycle of 7 plus 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1. So, and then also with the Tumult 1, it's a 16th note pattern based around a polyrhythm. So it's like a 3-4 polyrhythm. So then, and the whole movement is based around that. So what you're getting is like a juxtaposition of like these two things that are playing against each other, plus the delay, which creates like this 16th note kind of underpinning. It's kind of like a 16th note kick drum or whatever that's just going the whole time. Completely random accident that ended up being a cool thing. So that's what I do with the bridge percussion, and I abuse it way too often, but it's too much fun.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much. Did you consider, like, because you had a pretty straight ahead classical education, did you consider following a different path in university or just doing composition?
Well, okay, this is an interesting thing. I never felt like I needed to study composition. Mm-hmm. And that probably sounds really arrogant, but like, I just felt like, I mean, I did study it a little bit at Ottawa U. You know, I had some classes, which were really good because I had this like incentive to write music. So I had like a third and fourth year composition class. But I think, yeah, I don't know. Like, I didn't really have a portfolio that I could present to anyone for an undergraduate degree. I mean, really, I didn't have anything for undergrad. Like, I just kind of squeaked into Ottawa U, to be honest. And like, you know, I think they were almost not going to admit me, actually, you know, and I was kind of lucky. But because I was lucky, I took full advantage of it. And I really like went for it. And just, I was just really hungry, you know, and I figured, okay, I'm here. I'm basically, it's, you know, it's an opportunity to get as good as possible so that I have the tools to do whatever I want to do. I didn't really say that to people, but I always kind of felt
so
that
did
way.
You,
kind of
so did you practice less cello as a teen because you were doing so much other stuff? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't really have a sense of priorities. It was like I was doing it, but there wasn't like a main thing. But it seemed like the kind of the obvious thing to do, like, oh, I guess I should go to university and, well, I'm playing cello and, you know, it just seemed like the most kind of, it's weird to say, but like the smoothest path, you know, because like I was playing other instruments, but I didn't really have the sort of the connections, or it didn't feel like it was a strong enough sort of thing to work off of. Like I was playing flamenco guitar as a teenager, you know, which I don't really do so much now, but I did a lot then. And like, I remember my teacher said, well, you know, you could pay your way through college and stuff doing this. And I kind of had a vague idea of what that was, but it's like, you can't really go to university here to study that. You would have to study classical mm-hmm. guitar, which is a completely different yeah. beast, actually. And it didn't interest me at all. I wasn't interested in classical guitar. So, you know, and then with drumming too, it's like, you would need to go to a university and study like
yeah.
jazz, you know, and I wasn't good at jazz. I could play metal, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And like, so with cello, it was kind of like, okay, there's a program here. Like, you know, I know the teacher, and like, I live in Ottawa already, so I can just like live at home and kind of just go there. It was just kind of, I didn't even really consider anything else. So that's kind of how it started for me with my education. But, yeah, like, it's funny how these things sort of lead you on, and, you know, it's just sort of like how it all happens. But because of being in that environment, then I committed to it more because I thought, okay, like, I guess, you know, now that I'm also studying this, I should like try to use it in other places and kind of take advantage. And I was playing in bands. And so I was having this, like, not only the opportunity to like, you know, play popper etudes and stuff during the day, but also like play in groups where I was coming up with my own part, or I was learning existing material, or I was improvising. And so I was getting experience in another way, gigging and playing with people. And so it's kind of like a dual education in that sense. So, and I think, like, honestly, I always try to recommend this to people. I always say, like, if you're going to school, like, you should try to do that, you know, don't just be on campus and like try to get out there, because not all institutions really give you enough opportunities to go out and play and like, kind of get to know the scene and meet people. And as you were saying before, it's like knowing people is everything, really. It's like, if you have the relationships, you know, that's like kind of half the battle in your career. So you have to put yourself out there, and
yeah.
just also be a person, you know, not just like a player. You got to be a person and just be in society, I guess, be in the community. And now, especially, like, I feel responsibility to be there for the community also. When you're really young, it's like you just kind of, okay, what's going on, you know? But as you get a bit older, then you think, okay, like, how can I give back? And, like, how can I support people who are coming up? And, like, you know, maybe some other people haven't had certain opportunities, but maybe I think mm-hmm. they deserve it. Or, you know, just in general to help them, because it's like, I know that I appreciated that, you know, when I was starting out, that people connected me and, like, were willing to, you know, try working with me and stuff like that. So I feel like that's really important, to give back to the scene and, like, and to show up yeah. as well.
I'm curious about album review sites, because I know you're very good at submitting. So are there, and you're in the progressive world a lot. So are you submitting for those specific album review sites, or are there different ones you'd suggest for people?
I mean, there's yeah. so many. So where it kind of started for me was, like, my first record that I ever did, which is the Cholera Project, which is like a kind of progressive mm-hmm. death metal thing that I started as a teenager. And I mean, I had really no connections in town at that point when I started. I was doing that, and I didn't really know a lot of musicians. I kind of knew people through, like, MySpace, you know, it was back in those days. And, like, but I had this record that I felt, you know, was a cool thing, and I was putting a lot into it. So basically, I looked into different review sites, and I did a bit of research, and then I started reaching out to them. And at that time, I was actually still mailing a lot of stuff. Like, I would say probably people preferred actually that you would mail a CD rather than send them, like, MP3s or something. So I started with that, and I kind of learned how to pitch that way probably when I was, like, 17, 18. I started doing that. And then every time I released something, I kind of gained new contacts. So if it was, like, just maybe a single, or if it was a band project and we had a new album of some kind or whatever, then I was constantly making these new connections. So, like, with The Visit, for example, I remember that we released our first single. It was kind of like a 15-minute piece. It was, like, 2014, mm-hmm. and I had just worked, I was playing in a band called Little Sons at the time also, a completely different band that no longer exists, but we had done this record, and we were signed to a label, and so the label, I guess, had gotten, like, a bunch of reviews through their publicity, and so I actually kind of stole some of those review sites and then used them for The Visit, and a lot of those ended up being contacts that I still have. And then with Muskox, it's the same thing. Like, I basically just had experience pitching with every album, and then every time it was like I kind of had amassed extra contacts. But then, of course, every year it's like some blogs disappear, and then you have to find new ones, and you have to kind of keep your finger on the pulse. In general, what I would say is, at this stage, it's different now, I think, than it was. Like, it really helps, for example, if you've already connected with those people, like, on social media, and you've already had some interaction with them, it's so easy now to locate an individual. In the past, yeah. it was like, where do I find their email? How do I contact them? Like, you know, the website looked like it was from the 90s. It was, like, really hard to navigate. Or it was like, oh, do they even still write reviews? Like, now it's kind of like, oh, I could probably DM them on Instagram or, like, something like that. And
yeah.
So I would recommend to people, like, to figure out, first of all, like, what, I mean, again, I think both of us don't like the idea of, like, tagging music too specifically. But I think that the more you can get a sense, and sometimes you need to do, like, a survey with your fans to know what type of music you really play. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I do that. I try to do it. But then people just, like, say nice things. I'm like, no, I want you to give me, like, concrete information so I can market myself. But you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you can figure that out, and I think an easy one is also to name, like, five artists that sound like you, you know, and then mm-hmm. based on that, you can get a sense. Maybe you look at the reviews they've gotten. And so I think a big part of it is, like, yeah, kind of stealing what works for other people. And, like, I would say yeah. seeing, okay, if this person has done this thing, I could try it also. Or I could say, you know, I could pitch that review site, or whatever it happens to be, whatever that contact is, I could say, you know, hey, I'm a big fan of so-and-so, or I know so-and-so, and I know that they did this thing with you. Thought maybe you'd be interested in checking my stuff out, and maybe we could do, if you want to write a review, or we could do an interview or something, or, I mean, whatever the case may be, right? I would say that's always a good move, because the association will get you in. Or even better, if it's like you have someone who already puts in the word, and then you can follow up. You know, if you have a friend who's connected, maybe they can make the introduction, but you don't have to have that. With, yeah, prog and metal, there's like almost an overabundance of websites that cover music. And so if you play that type of music, it's very easy. Like, that's what I learned quickly, is that I think it's like you have a huge advantage if you play that type of music over anything else, in a way, because there's more sites that will cover stuff. Jazz, to a degree, there's a good amount of stuff too, but I think jazz is a smaller niche in terms of the review sites and the scene. So that would be my recommendation, but definitely like amassing contacts, having active socials where it's like you're connecting with people and you're kind of like working the room a little bit. You have lots of stuff that's easily accessible that people can listen to. And I would say, in terms of making a pitch, like, I would say I probably got a response like every 1 out of 10 emails, roughly. With Worlds Within, I went all out on the promotion, actually, for the reviews. And it, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I might as well, you know, to see what happens. And I gave it a lot of lead time, too. So the album came out January 2020. I started emailing sites in October 2019, and I just gradually got through my list. I had a massive list by this point, and I just, like, I was on tour, and so I would actually try to send like 5 to 10 emails a day on tour. And when I got home, I just continued. And then, so I think that that's a good way, is to like give yourself a lot of lead time, and at least then people have the album or they have the promo, and then you can follow up. Like, I think nowadays, like, people will kind of forget a little bit if you don't sort of let them know a month in advance, maybe. And then it's just the perfect window for them to write about it and then maybe publish the week before it comes out, which is the best time usually. But then I think having reviews later is great too. Like, I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's nice to be able to extend the campaign, and those people are doing it for you, so that's really nice. Actually, speaking of, like, we were talking about having someone who's already been reviewed that, you know, you could sort of piggyback on. Like, I had a connection like that with The Guardian, actually. So, you know, there's a guy that wrote a little bit about Worlds Within in The Guardian, and it was only because I knew someone who he had written a good review for not too long ago, and I thought the music is similar enough, and we had also done a show together. So then it was kind of like, might as well just try this and see. So, yeah, it's just about, again, putting yourself out there a lot. And then, like, it's 1 in 10, really. But then the more you put yourself out there, the more you get back. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about musical influences. And it was interesting, some of the things I was hearing you talk about in other interviews is you love the sound of the Armenian duduk. And I was like, oh, that instrument is such a cool instrument. We hear it a lot in movies, soundtracks. Which leads me to a couple things. One thing I was curious about is your music, a lot of it's very cinematic. Have you been commissioned to write for any shows
I
yet?
Personally haven't. I've played on a lot of cool shows and movies, mostly shows. I've worked a lot with Andrew Lockington, who's a film and TV composer, I guess, who's like, he's very esteemed. Like, he's really up in that kind of that world with like Hollywood movies and stuff. And we've done a lot of cool things. I mean, he's a really cool composer, and I think he is good at like sort of getting me in on a project and just capitalizing on the spontaneity of my playing and just finding a place for it and giving the right instructions and working through all these cues very quickly and just kind of knowing what to ask for and how to integrate that stuff. So that's been a cool process for me, because most of what I was playing wasn't scored out. Like, there's a few set themes that I would sight read and then we'd record them, you know, but most of it was like, okay, I've got this cue here, can you do this type of thing? And then we would do 2 to 3 takes and then boom, next one. So That's been cool. And I'm working kind of on and off with a longtime friend, Laura Bidner, who I actually went to high school with. And she's also like now a full-time film composer, film and TV. And yeah, there's like a series that she's scoring that I'm playing on pretty regularly too. And yeah, really cool stuff. So I like that stuff a lot. I mean, you kind of don't really know what you're going to get sometimes, but it's also part of the fun of it, I think, is that I think in a different way from like an album, I feel less attachment to it. And because of that, sometimes I think that I actually come up with cooler stuff. Sometimes like holding on to something too tightly and caring about it too much can get in your way. And like, so this idea of kind of non-attachment and just kind of going with the flow and just sort of letting these moments pass, you know, and just doing whatever makes sense for that specific thing and then just forgetting about it is really nice, you know. Yeah. And with those projects, it's often that way because the turnaround is so quick, much quicker than music. I mean, they have like this whole apparatus and they've got these deadlines and there's a lot more budget and everything. So it's often like you get asked to do something and it has to be delivered within like a day or two. And it's so different from music where, like, you know, there's stuff that I worked on like last year that still hasn't come out, even things like from 2019 that I recorded on that still haven't come out. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different world altogether, but I enjoy it a lot. I would love to actually compose for film or TV, you know, that would be super fun. I think it's, again, because it's a different world, it's like you need different connections. So I've mostly been in it as a player, but it's been cool for me to at least get a sense of what it's like. I don't know if I'd be cut out for the turnaround. And like, I think for me, like, I like to linger with something until I feel like it's really good. And sometimes you don't always get to do that. Sometimes I think you have to, like, you really have to be super efficient. And I don't think it's my strong point, you know. Like, I think for me, it's like I need to kind of get into the process. And then I start to get a rhythm. And then finally, like, the good stuff comes out. I have to kind of coax it out over time. I can't just go into it cold necessarily, especially from a creative standpoint, and feel like, yeah. But again, it's often like letting go of the feeling that you need to be making your best work and just doing the work, because you don't know also what is going to be your best work or how other people will see it. Like, and that's something I've realized, is that often people like a thing that you thought was a throwaway, and or maybe even not that good, and you don't know what people are going to like. And so in that sense, it's better just to keep making and keep putting it out there, because you don't know what's going to hit. And I think that for any person who's creating, it's like, it's really difficult to be the judge of your own work and to know what things among your own work are actually the best. And I think that time, of course, always eventually reveals that, you know, the things that are really good tend to last and resonate with people over a longer period, and the other things might kind of maybe fade into obscurity a little bit more. And there's a reason for that. I think certain things just resonate a lot. But of course, we feel a certain attachment to what we make in a more personal way, so it's harder for us to like see that clearly.
Yeah. So about the Duduk, like, I don't know if it's pronounced Duduk, but yeah, so it's interesting with this podcast because I listen to a lot of music I wouldn't otherwise listen to. So then I was listening to some of that music, and then I thought, I have to find a Duduk player to interview, of course. So then, you know, I did a couple cold calls, and one of the people who responded, I won't give it away because they're going to be in an upcoming episode, such an interesting musician, just like one of my dream guests. I was like, all right. And it's interesting with these cold calls. Sometimes I have connections, and sometimes it's just someone I don't know at all, and they're just, all right, sure, I'll talk to you. Let's do that. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Kamancello, because Shahryar Jamshidi was a guest on this podcast.
Yeah, I listened to the interview, loved it. Yeah,
and you had mentioned in another interview that you had grown up hearing another Kurdish-Iranian player, Kayhan Kalhor, who I guess was living in Ottawa in the early 90s. Did you hear him live here?
I actually didn't hear him live here until pretty recently. Okay. He was playing with Kiat Abasyan, like it must have been 2018 or 19, can't really remember, but it was pretty recently. But then he was playing setar, actually. He wasn't playing Camanche. It was a little bit like, you know, going to see someone who does something that's like very specific to them, but then they don't do that thing. I mean, he's great, but like, but of course he's like synonymous with this instrument, you know, and it's because of his playing primarily that I got into it, you know, growing up, because we had like CDs of it in the house, and we're listening to a lot of Persian music. And then actually there were some concerts here that I saw, at like the, universities, like on campus, you know. It was like a Dastan ensemble, and they played twice in Ottawa when I was like, I think like 12, 13, 14. Like I saw them on two different occasions. So that was really exciting for me to actually see those instruments, because I'd been listening to the records. And at that point, like I would listen to the CD, and then I would like look at the liner notes, and I would kind of get to know about the instruments. So I was really fascinated. So I had this background in it already from having heard it a lot, and I knew what the instruments were, and I had some understanding about Persian modality. But again, like I think a lot of it was very intuitive. And so, you know, when I found out about Shahryar, I was kind of like, okay, we have to meet. Like, this has to happen, you know. It would just be so cool to get together and play. You know, there's moments where you think, oh yeah, there's a cool musician out there, maybe we should reach out, maybe I should reach out, but I, you know, it just doesn't happen. But there was something really spontaneous about that, right? You know, someone had told me they had played a improvised concert with him. And at this point, like, I was living in Toronto, and I was playing a lot of these improvised music nights, where a lot of them were kind of self-curated. You would kind of like just sign up, and different people from the community would be there, and you would just play with them and see what came out. And so someone had recommended that I maybe try to reach out, and you know, they had done something together. And so I just, yeah, I sent him a message, and I said, hey, do you want to maybe just play together? And he was open to it, and we just played for like 2 hours straight, barely talked, and it was really good. So then we ended up doing one of those improvised music shows. We signed up, and of course we were kind of cheating because we had played together for 2 hours already, so it wasn't a completely like blind date, so to speak, but it was great. It was, I mean, for me, like the best one that I had done really in that way. And I think, you know, earlier I talked about having a musical affinity with someone.
Yeah.
And with him, it's like we're just like, you know, when we play together, I just, it's just like instant, like high speed connection, you know. I just feel like we understand each other. And it's not really anything to do with, it's just, yeah, like we're very well matched musically, I think. And so over time also, I think it got better, and like, because we played together more. So you understand, like, you know, at first when you meet someone, you've only talked to them about a few things, so you don't know their boundaries yet. You don't know, like, maybe we won't go there, you know. But like, of course, yeah, with more shows and stuff, we kind of got a sense of like the range of expression that we had, and maybe where we wouldn't venture, but also like finding new territory that was experimental for us. You know, because sometimes you do things that feel safe and comfortable, but then you want to try to do something that feels a little unusual on stage, and that creates contrast within the set as well. So, yeah, you know, it's been a really exciting thing to do that. It was a really unexpected journey, in a sense that, like, I thought maybe we would play a few shows together, but then we ended up becoming this like formed group, and you know, made 3 albums together, and like did this thing with the Windsor Symphony, and you know, like basically we had our own concerto that we kind of had to create to play with them, and all this stuff. So it's been a lot more than what I could have imagined. And so, you know, I remember with the pandemic, because we haven't played together since the beginning of 2020, actually. But I had this feeling of like, well, okay, if we never got to play together again, this would already be, you know, would have exceeded my expectations. So that's been really cool. And but it seems now that he's moving back to Canada, actually. So yeah, we're gonna do some shows together later this year, and so I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I saw that. I was excited too. The thing with Windsor Symphony, did you write out the parts for the orchestra?
Yeah. So what happened was, they had reached out to us because they wanted to do something with Middle Eastern music. And we had just put out our first album, and it was on Bandcamp. And so, and it was the conductor, Robert France, and he had just like looked this up on Google. I think it was like Middle Eastern like music and like cello or Canada or Ontario or something. And then like found us like right away and then listened. And he thought, oh, that's cool. Okay. And then so we got this, you know, email like not long after putting out the first album. So then it was this long process of communication, like, okay, well, what's the piece going to be? And of course, being like the second thing on the program, we have the concerto, it should be like about 20 minutes. So, you know, Shahryar had this, like, he had a piece of his own, which was like kind of the starting point. It was like a solo Kamanche piece. And then basically, I remember I got that and then I decided, well, maybe we should have like a multi-movement thing. So we had stuff from one of our, it was from our second album, actually, mostly. There was a piece on that album that had some melodies in 7-8, and then I thought it would be cool to maybe have like a 7-8 movement and then like kind of a slow, free movement where the orchestra is kind of suspended and then we're improvising and then almost like an improvised cadenza into the last movement, which is his Kurdish piece, which is like a fast 2-4 piece. So yeah, I wrote all the orchestra parts to go with that. And I mean, the first movement is kind of, I basically composed it around like things that we had improvised. So, you know, a lot of the melodies were his actually, that like, it was sort of like, okay, how can we create like a structure out of this and then orchestrate it and do something that would be kind of interesting on all levels. Like it's not just us playing, but the orchestra is really a part of the action. It was really cool. I mean, it was a lot of fun to do that. So we played that concert in Windsor in 2019, and then we did like a chamber version with like a small string ensemble twice in Ottawa, actually. And that was a lot of fun too. It's like nice to do it with a smaller group because it's like you have that flexibility. I think for Shahryar, I remember it was like a little bit like being thrown in the deep end. I told him, I was like, you know, when we play with this orchestra, we can't move them once they're at a certain tempo. Like, that's it. And he's like, ah, yeah, whatever, you know. And then first rehearsal, he kind of went, oh, I see what you mean, you know. And but they were great. Like, I have to say, it was a really efficient process with the rehearsing and like to mount that piece and get it to all work. Like I was really impressed by how it all went down in that way. It was just like, you know, I think because of the timing too, it's like, and we had this pandemic, you know, that happened, but like it would have been nice to get to do it again not too long after, in a way, because when you build up something like that, it's like you need a little bit of experience to kind of break it into and like maybe, you know, work with a different group or whatever. So it would be nice, you know, at some point, but it's so tricky also with that type of thing, like, because you have to kind of have a very strong argument for like, well, why would we do this Canadian concerto when we could do this one? You know what I mean? I think we're both like really invested in doing that project more because it's a way of bringing together kind of what we do in an improvised way. It's very intimate into this big context that involves like a written piece and classical music and like a different kind of sphere altogether, really. And it's called Convergence Suite. It's the name of the piece. And that was kind of the idea. It's like these worlds colliding a little bit. And it was the first time that we had really played a scripted thing together, actually. But I think that it was a bit more secure in the sense that like it was based off of the type of material we had already played. So it didn't just feel like we were doing something completely alien together. You know what I mean? Like it was still the same type of music that we were doing. So.
Yeah. Well, one of the main points for me of putting so much into the series that I do is just showing the breadth and the depth of a life in music. And these kind of projects just brings more listeners to different kinds of music, which is so great.
Yeah, for sure. It's like it really opens people up. And I think also like playing in Windsor, it was kind of like, I think a lot of people had never heard that type of music before. It was really new for them. You know, I think with that orchestra in particular, it's like they do a lot of outreach, and they're really getting into like, they're trying to get into the community to, you know, get them interested, even just, I think, in the really standard classics, you know. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the nicest things about that experience was not even the concert itself, but we went and played at a school, and we just played in a school gym for these kids, and we had this really, it was like a really kind of genuine improvisation. And, you know, sometimes when you go and play for like elementary school, it's like maybe they're not all kind of focused, or like they're kind of maybe not all there, but like these kids were like really into it. And I think there was this really strong sense of connection. And I felt like we had kind of done something like valuable in that. And it was really kind of nourishing, you know, to be there, even though it was just this kind of very simple setting of us just like showing up with our instruments in the gym, you know, and playing for some kids. And like, but that really stuck with me actually. And it was a nice thing to get to do. And, you know, I know that like, yeah, some people, I guess when they do like concertos and stuff, that they do the outreach. And I think it's nice, you know, it's nice to kind of be like on the ground with people and to really have that communication and not just be on the stage. I think that it, you know, cause it brings people closer to that as well. And it's not like this thing that's kind of out there that you can't relate to, you know, as you just kind of maybe in awe of it, but you don't really understand it fully or. So I appreciate that side of it a lot too.
Yeah. Well, I know you've agreed to play, and I don't, we have to have a different mic set up. So I'm not going to pretend that we don't splice that in earlier in the episode, which it will end up being. But I want to thank you for your time today, since it's the end of our big conversation.
For sure, yeah.
And thanks so much for your perspectives and your experience. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And it's been really nice talking with you and talking about lots of different things too. I appreciate all your questions and everything. So, yeah.
If you missed part one of this episode, it is linked in the description. Raph demonstrates and talks about the first part of Worlds Within, and you get to hear about his career as a studio musician and his experiences touring with Leprous. He shares his thoughts about knowing yourself, being creative, connecting with your audience, and balancing your life and expectations of yourself. My life is so enriched by getting to know all these fascinating musicians on this series. Please check out more of these episodes. I speak with a diverse range of musicians following different career and creative paths. All these episodes are available in both video and podcast format. Everything is linked in the description of the episode to my website, leahroseman.com.